because I've missed it, yeah? I've missed it, yeah? But it's ready to go. Okay. So, I'll just start off, just maybe give it a few minutes, just to talk a little bit about meditation practice again, just to get this started, and then we'll get into the real thing in a minute or two, and then we will do some do a Dhamma talk afterwards. Yeah. So, as I was saying yesterday, one of the kind of crucial aspects of meditation practice is the sense, you know, it's actually an attitude that you have within your meditation, so that you feel good about yourself, you feel a sense of joy ideally inside of you, all of these things, this attitude, the kind of the mental state that you bring to the meditation is so important and so crucial. So the question is always, how do we get to that point where we feel good, we feel a sense of, you know, softness inside, not being hard-hearted, all of these kinds of things. How do we get to that particular point? And this is one of those really important aspects of meditation practice. And one of the teachings that the Buddha gives about this is where he talks about what is called the sila anusandhana, right? Sila, of course, is like conduct or whatever. And anusati is basically the recollection. It's about the recollection of your conduct. How do you live your life? Do you live your life well? And all of these kind of things. And of course, one aspect of that is the fact that many of you, I'm sure, you keep the five precepts, probably, you know, many of you. And that is part of that, the fact that you are, you know, living your life according to the Buddhist morality. But remember, sometimes that is not enough. Right? If you really want to have that joy and happiness in meditation, five precepts itself is not actually sufficient. And the reason why sometimes it isn't sufficient, it can be sufficient, but sometimes it's not. And the reason is because after a while it becomes like a habit, right? You become habitually good, habitually good person. So because, and it's great to be habitually good, of course, it's a wonderful thing. But because it becomes like a habit, there isn't much intention involved in it anymore. There isn't much kind of, you don't have to kind of put your mind to it. It's actually, it just comes automatically that you keep the five precepts. It's a bit like when you've been a monk like me for over 20 years, you know, all these rules that you have to keep, and after a while they become just like second nature. You don't even think about them anymore. It's just pretty much straightforward. So there's very little intention involved, whether it's the five precepts or the monastic rules or whatever. So, because intention is karma is intention, because these things are so closely related to each other, it means that if you put a lot of intention into something, the karma is far more powerful. So one of the important things to do on the Buddhist path is to make sure that you don't just be as satisfied with keeping the five precepts, that you ask yourself, how can I actually do good things in my daily life, right? You take every opportunity you have to do things that are wholesome, that are positive, help somebody out with something, little things, little acts of generosity, little acts of kindness in daily life. These don't have to be big acts. What is important is that you do things frequently and regularly, that you are on the lookout for possibilities of doing good things. Because if you are on the lookout, it means that your intention is very strong. You're actually actively intending to do good things. And this has a very powerful impact on you, because when you are actively on the lookout like that, it makes a very powerful impact on your mind. It really makes this impact on your mind. And I've noticed that in my own life. Sometimes I ask myself, what can I say to this person? Right? Somebody's there, and sometimes it's nice to say a few pleasantries. I don't have to talk a lot, but just a little bit. And I think, well, what can I say to this person which is kind, right? How can I make this person feel a little bit better, rather than making them feel miserable by saying something nasty? Right? How can I say something which actually would make a happy day for this person? And then you actively intend to say something kind. And when you do it that way, it leaves a strong impact on your mind. And sometimes I've seen myself doing that kind of many times in a row. And after a while you look back and you think, wow,
that's actually very nice, right? And it makes you, it lifts you up, and it makes you feel so much better about yourself because you have actively intended to do acts of kindness. Acts, speech. And of course, if you feel a bit grumpy one day and it's hard to do the act of kindness, don't do anything at all. Just stay with it. You know, don't make sure you actually don't act on those things. And then if you're able to transform that mental state of being a bit negative and still do something positive, often there's a very powerful intention behind that that enables you to transform that. So these are the kind of things that are really powerful and have a very powerful impact on your meditation practice. Then when you sit down to meditate, right, you don't have to do very much. I mentioned the word Sila-nusati, which is a recollection of your conduct or your character, however you want to translate that. You don't have to use much force or power to then recollect these things. It's quite natural. It happens almost by itself. You just ask yourself, well, what did I do today? That was, you know, what are the good things I did today? And the mind just goes back there almost by itself. And remember those things. And it lifts your mental state up, right? You feel, wow, that's great. It's not kind of a selfish or egotistical thing at all. It's just you feel good about your life. It lifts you up. And that enables you to feel more peace and happiness in your meditation. So this is the fast track, right? People are always looking for the shortcut. This is the real shortcut. You want a shortcut in your meditation, but this is the real thing. And then you can start to see how meditation is so integrated into the rest of the Noble Eightfold Path. Meditation is not something that stands on its own. It is absolutely crucial to get all these factors together. And if you practice these factors in a powerful way, really to the maximum of your ability, wow, then you are really putting a lot of kind of rocket power into your meditation practice in that way. So this is just a few little hints for you, just to kind of to enhance the spiritual practice. Because sometimes we wonder, you know, how come I'm not making as much progress as I would like to do? And these are kind of some of the critical issues that often lie behind there. Okay, so now let us try out and see what happens in practice, if this actually works or not. So, as always, just start off by closing your eyes and feeling your body, and ensure that you have no pains, that you are nice and comfortable, first of all. This is always the starting point. It's nice sometimes to get into nice habits with the meditation practice, to do a similar kind of procedure every time, because if you do that, it's almost like automatic. And you're heading in the right direction. If you skip some of the steps, that automaticness tends to disappear a little bit at the same time.
stay with the physical body for a while, then just to make sure that you're completely relaxed and at ease, and to stay with the body until that job is done. Feel really, oh, it's so nice just to sit here, and you don't really want to do anything else in the whole world. So just focus on that body, and as you focus on the body, the mind tends to become peaceful at the same time. So allow the body to relax, get into the right attitude, have a sense of compassion for yourself, and allow yourself to relax and feel good. Remember that it is the attitude that is the most important thing in the meditation practice. So just to help you to have the right attitude, just imagine yourself that you are the carer for your body. The body has been your slave through all these years, always being there at your beck and command, always doing exactly what it's told. Now it is your turn to look after the body. Body, now I will look after you in return. Thank you for all the services that you have provided for all these years. Now relax and enjoy. Just have a good time. Make it pleasant. It's important for it to be pleasant, because when it's pleasant, mindfulness will tend to arise all by itself. Just by focusing on being at ease and being content and feeling good, mindfulness tends to become stronger, and there's nothing else you have to do. There's no struggle there. There's no hardship, just a natural process happening by itself. Just again, the attitude here is the most important thing. And what a wonderful thing it is to be able to be right here in the middle of one of the really big cities of the world, having a sense of a good company, a sense of peace in a beautiful place. What an awesome and remarkable thing that is. Just by enjoying the present moment, allowing yourself to feel the power and the beauty of that, mindfulness happens by itself. You allow the meditation just to be a natural process. It becomes so easy. It becomes so free of pain and problems and conflicts. And it becomes something very beautiful that you always can come back to. Something to enhance your life. And what is beautiful about this is that when mindfulness starts to arise, it's a bit as if you feel like you are an island in the world. You become detached from your surroundings, and you start to see the surroundings in a kind of neutral, detached way. And this is the idea for the meditation. You're just sitting back, you're hearing sounds coming and sounds passing away, but you have no involvement with those things. Because you have no involvement, there is no emotional reaction to those sounds. You see the thoughts coming and passing away, no emotional reaction. Just observance of what is happening here. That is when you know that the mindfulness is going in the right direction. simply ask yourself if there is anything in recent times that you're still feeling good about, something that you did or something that you said that made an impact on your mind. Get into that feeling. If you felt good, give rise to that feeling now, just by remembering that feeling is also coming into the present moment. Allow these kind of things to give you a boost in your meditation, to clear up the mind, to make it more joyful, and then to allow you afterwards to progress even further. part of the meditation. And once again, ask yourself, how do you feel now? Do you feel more peaceful and more at ease? And feel that the mind state is better now than it was before? Then ask yourself why that is the case. And try to understand the causes and conditions that lead to an improvement in the mind. And as you understand these things, start to understand how it works. And then you can take charge of your meditation practice. Okay, so let's have a 10-minute break or so. I'll see you back in here again. It's 10 minutes time. White with a bit of sugar will be great.
I'll have this one as well. It's only coming. Yeah, somebody had a look at that, yeah. Yes, great. Well, thank you.
Okay, shall we start? Okay. So, everybody, most people are here, and so great that we can start again and continue with the program. And this morning, the talk is supposed to be of karma and rebirth, one of the kind of perennial questions in Buddhism about karma and rebirth. And it's good to think about these things and try to gain and understand, not just a theoretical understanding about karma and rebirth, but an understanding which actually helps you to make progress on the path and to act in the right way and do all the kind of right things. But the idea is in Buddhism is not, Buddhism is not kind of a dogma, it's not a kind of a theory, this is the theory, believe it or, you know, or whatever. The idea is just, these are teachings that are supposed to be useful in our practice. And the same thing is true for karma and rebirth as well. It's important to make it into something practical rather than something just purely theoretical, which just kind of logs, kind of gets stuck to the back of your head, and then you argue with other people about it, right? Is it right? Is it wrong? That's not really the point. The point is to give it a bit of a boost in the practice. That's what it ultimately comes down to now. So, one of the interesting things that I always found about the idea, especially of rebirth, that karma is a bit different, but rebirth is how prevalent it is, how you find it pretty much in all cultures. And I was mentioning yesterday how they had this survey in Europe and the US, and how such a large percentage of the population actually have an idea, a feeling that rebirth is true. If you like to believe in rebirth, you can probably put it that way, yeah. Right? 25% of the population, regardless of religious background or no religious background or whatever, they actually have a belief, if you like, in rebirth. And that is despite the fact that Christianity does not teach rebirth, right? It's not really a Christian belief. So one of the questions in this survey they did was, well, why is it that so many people in the Europe and US actually believe in this, even though it goes against the prevailing ideas of the Christian Church and all of these kind of things? And one of the reasons they found out that people believe in this, well, this is at least what they thought, is that a lot of the original religions in Europe before Christianity came in, right? In the Nordic countries, as I was saying yesterday, you had there was a religion there, and it's true, it concerned Thor and Odin and all of these people, but it was actually more sophisticated than that. It wasn't just kind of believing in the thunder god in the sky. It was more than that. And part of that Nordic religion itself was actually a belief in reincarnation. And you go to the ancient Greeks believed in reincarnation, and it seemed to have been a fairly cross Europe, the ancient religion before Christianity, and reincarnation was actually part of that. And if you look around the world, there have been some very interesting anthropological surveys done on this question. There's a very famous Sri Lankan anthropologist called something like Gananath Ubayasekara, and he did some anthropological studies around the world, and basically find people everywhere around the world whose religion includes the idea of reincarnation. So there's all these different places, right, where the idea of reincarnation seems to kind of pop up into society, which is very interesting indeed. So how do we, just by way of background, so how do we actually relate to this? What do we do? Recently, I don't know if you have seen the website called Sutta Central. I know some of you have. This is kind of Ajahn Sujato's kind of a brainchild, if you like, is building up this website where you can access all the early suttas in a vast number of different languages. You can search it backwards and forwards in all kinds of ways. And it's a very, very nice website for if you're interested in the early Buddhist texts. But also there is a platform there for having discussions, right? And of course, various kinds of discussions always going on. And because a lot of the people, not all of them, but a large percentage are Westerners, Western background, the discussions are often quite, you know, that people discuss without much boundaries, so to speak. And which is nice sometimes, especially as a monk, sometimes it's good to be challenged a little bit, right, on these kind of issues. And one of the questions there that we discussed recently was precisely the idea of rebirth. In Western societies, some people find this much more controversial, and it often gets dismissed as just religious doctrine or something like that. Whereas other Westerners have no problem with this idea. In many Asian societies, you often grow up with the idea of rebirth. Right? Here in Thailand, you grow up with the idea of rebirth. It's kind of part of you. You never even think about it. Of course there is rebirth. The same thing in Sri Lanka. I'm not sure about Singapore. Is that automatic belief in Singapore or not really? Yeah, Singapore is slightly different, right? It's not quite as steeped in the in Buddhism as Thailand and Sri Lanka is. So how, what should our attitude be? And of course, the first thing, as always, is to go back to the word of the Buddha and ask, what did the Buddha have to say about this? And one of the things that is so clear when you read the suttas is that the idea of rebirth is everywhere in the suttas. It is a core aspect of the teachings of the Buddha. So when people say, oh yeah, I'm not sure if the Buddha really taught rebirth, you know, it's uncertain, that's absolute nonsense. Because it's absolutely everywhere. And some of the, it's not just everywhere as part of the stories, as part of the kind of side issues, if you like, in the suttas, it's absolutely part of the core teachings. So for example, to give you some ideas here, the Four Noble Truths, right? Now if the Four Noble Truths isn't core teaching, then nothing is core teaching, yeah. Right? So, second noble truth, what does it say? It says that it's called the Samudaya, the arising truth, the truth about arising. Yeah. And it says that the truth about arising is that craving. Yeah. Right? The arising of suffering, that is. The truth about the arising of suffering is craving. What kind of craving? The craving that leads to rebirth. Ponobhavika tanha. Ponobhavika means that leads to rebirth. It's right there in the Four Noble Truths. And if you start to look around, you see everywhere all the core teachings, right? Dependent origination, you have rebirth. I'll talk about that perhaps a bit more in a second. In the idea of Buddhist morality, it tells you, right view is that there is rebirth. It's part of Buddhist morality, right? It's very interesting. It's right there. It's in the gradual training, which is the training, as I was mentioning yesterday, we're going to have more look at this afterwards, it's part of the training, is the recollection of past lives and the understanding of rebirth. Right? When you get awakened, right? When you finally get enlightened, when you finally become an arahat, right? That's kind of where we're all trying to go, right? Some slowly, some fast, some various kind of speeds, but eventually you want to get there. So what do you know when you become an arahat? Well, the one insight that is always repeated everywhere you become an arahat is birth has come to an end, right? There is no more rebirth. This is the one insight that the arahat has. And also the insight that the Buddha had when he was moving, when he reached awakening. So it's there in all the kind of core teachings of Buddhism, the idea of rebirth. But sometimes it is important to understand this, because once you understand that, at least you have, you have some kind of foundation for how to look at this problem. The Buddha very clearly said that there is rebirth. So this is the first point to remember. The second point is, why did the Buddha say there is rebirth? Right? Some people say, oh, it's just a cultural conditioning in India. Everybody says it's rebirth, so the Buddha says it's rebirth. Does that sound like the Buddha? Does the Buddha kind of just say things because everybody else says something? Doesn't sound like the Buddha, right? And the whole point of being a Buddha is that you investigate. You look at things. You kind of step aside. Remember the Buddha, he rejected pretty much all the teachers that existed in India at the time. And he said, no, this doesn't lead to awakening. I have to find my own path. Right? So the Buddha was about radical investigation, looking at things from his own point of view, not just being caught up in the beliefs and the way things were done traditionally. He was an inquirer. So the idea that the Buddha just went along with the beliefs just goes against the whole idea of what the Buddha was like. And in any case, at that time in India, there were teachers who didn't believe in rebirth. They already existed. And the Buddha actually talks about those, right? So it wasn't as if it was the whole social culture pushed in one direction. The culture was very diverse. This is one of the beautiful things that you see in the sutta. There's all the arguments they were having, right? They were discussing it. And they had some of the wildest views you can imagine in the sutta. So very diverse, a lot of plurality, discussion, just like, you know, ideally we would like to have it today. Many similarities, perhaps, between modern society and the society in India. Although, perhaps, they were even more open at that time to these things. So the Buddha didn't take this from the culture around him. In fact, he says very clearly in the suttas that he has awakened to these things. This is part of the Buddha's awakening, the understanding of rebirth. It's not the dogma. It's not something, believe this, you know, and everything else is wrong. That's not really what it's like. What it's like is, I have awakened to this. Because I have awakened to this, the Buddha says, this is the way the world functions. This is the way the world is. It's not a speculation, it's not some kind of just random idea, it's not a dogma, it is the Buddha awakening to this truth. And this is kind of very important, because once you realize that, it starts to become clear what your attitude to rebirth should be. Right? So if you consider yourself to be a Buddhist, if you are convinced that the teachings of the Buddha are really awesome, right? That's what I reckon, they're really awesome teachings. But if they really are awesome, then what should we say when the Buddha says something that, well, yeah, I'm not so sure about this rebirth idea? What should we do? Should we say, okay, that idea is rubbish, but take everything else? Is that the right attitude? And I say, no, if you really think that the Buddha is the greatest spiritual master who has ever existed on this planet, which basically, as far as I'm concerned, is exactly what he is. He is a spiritual genius that was able to break through the veil of delusion. Now, if you really think that, and the Buddha says, I have awakened to rebirth, there is such a thing as rebirth, well, the response should be, whoa, if the Buddha says that, I guess I've got to take it seriously, right? It doesn't mean that, okay, in that case, this becomes a dogma, and this is the truth, everything else is false. But what it means is that you take it seriously. And it becomes, you know, it's not something that you dismiss easily if somebody of the Buddha's caliber said that it is true. And that is the right way of approaching this as a Buddhist. And when people to me say, oh yeah, I've been investigating this idea of, you know, rebirth, and yeah, I know the Buddha said so, but really I can't really accept it, and I'm going to reject it. And the question is, well, if you are rejecting something the Buddha said, then are you really a Buddhist? Isn't the idea of being a Buddhist, at the very least, that you are open-minded at the very least about the things that the Buddha taught? If you're closing off the possibility that the Buddha was right, then of course you have to ask yourself whether that is compatible with the idea of being a Buddhist. Especially if you have thought about this for a long period of time and then in the end you have decided to reject it. So that is the right attitude, right? The Buddha says in the suttas, I am the teacher, I have seen, I know what is going on. You are just a student. The right attitude is to assume that I have seen things in the right way, that I am right. That should be the right attitude. I know you don't. For that reason, that's the right attitude. So, this does not mean, again, that we take this as a dogma, this is the truth, and I'm going to argue with everyone who kind of says it is wrong. That's not what it means. It means that you are still humble about it because you realize, okay, I believe this, but belief is different from knowledge. I don't actually know when there's rebirth, right? So because I don't know, okay, there's still some degree of uncertainty there. But in my heart, yes, I think there is rebirth. It kind of resonates with me, right? That is kind of the right attitude. Which means that if somebody challenges you, you say, okay, fair enough, I don't really know 100% myself, but it is just my personal conviction that this is how, what it is like. Yeah. And then you are taking these things on board in the right way. Yeah. Because, again, the reason why the Buddha teaches rebirth is because it has tremendous ramifications for the path. I have always noticed that those people who are opposed to rebirth, that very often they are not monastics, right? Often they are ex-monastics. They disrobe, they realize they couldn't really believe in rebirth, then they disrobe. And then they go teaching the whole world about how it's possible to understand Buddhism without rebirth. But it's false. They are claiming to be followers of the Buddha, when in fact they are only partially followers of the Buddha. And this is, I think, a very dangerous territory to get into. And, of course, the reason why you disrobe if you don't believe in rebirth is because the stakes aren't as high. If you believe in rebirth, the stakes are really high. There is this potential for, you know, keeping on in this existence, keeping on traveling on in the future forevermore. Imagine doing all the things in this life that you have done again. Forever, right? Again and again and again. And after a while, we get so fed up with that. Sometimes if I look back at my life, I had quite a good life, actually, in many ways. But if I was going to do everything again, oh, dukkha, terrible, right? I don't want to do it all again. I mean, kind of, you know, being a monk for 20 years, it's great to be a monk, but you know, you have to, it's also a steep learning curve. I want to go through a steep learning curve one more time. Enough of all of that. So you start to see, it changes your attitude to existence once you have some idea of rebirth. So that is rebirth and how to look at that. Now, what about karma? Right, karma is slightly different. So how do we deal with karma? Karma is actually in some ways easier to accept than rebirth, because karma is something that you can actually feel and experience right here and right now. So when you read the suttas, it talks about different types of karma. It talks about the karma whose result is experienced in future life, or way down the track, right, many, many lifetimes in the future. So karma has this potential for ripening way down the track. Yeah. But there's also one type of karma the suttas talk about. It's called the Dittava Dhamma Karma, which is the karma that pertains to this very life. Right? So the results can be experienced in this life. And this is the kind of karma which is the most interesting to think about, because if it can be experienced in this life, it is likely that you will be able to understand the idea of karma just through your own experience. That is useful, right? Because if you understand it through your own experience, it becomes much more easy to accept it. So how does this work? And actually, it is fairly simple when you think about it. Right? You do an act of kindness. Right? You do something really kind. One day you just feel like being kind to somebody, and you just kind of open up your heart and you give something or you say something. And then with that act of kindness, if it really comes from your heart, how do you feel about that? You feel good, right? You feel really happy about that, doing an act of kindness. Not only do you feel happy at that particular time, but whenever you remember that act afterwards. And this is what I was talking about before, about the idea of remembering some of your good acts. Whenever you remember that afterwards, it also makes you feel good. Right? So this is karma. This is karma right there. The fact that you experience happiness in the here and now because you've done something good, and you can see the connection directly there in your mind. Now I'm kind to you, and because I'm kind to you, I feel happy. That is the result of karma right there. So very easy to see. And you can also see the opposite, right? Sometimes you do something bad, you say the wrong thing to somebody, right? And afterwards, how do you feel about yourself when you do something bad? You don't feel very happy about yourself. You feel kind of miserable. You go, oh, I shouldn't have done that. That was a mistake. I was overcome by my defilements, right, at that time. I didn't really know what I was doing. I wish I could sort it out. And of course, you can sort it out to some extent. So you do that. You ask the person, oh, please forgive me for my silliness. It was just my defilements or whatever. And you know, that sort of thing. So you can sort of sort it out afterwards. But you can again see that thing. And sometimes these bad things that we did in the past, they can resonate in your mind, right? Sometimes you think about them years down the track. So that is the bad karma. Again, you can feel the karma right here, right now, in this very existence. This is really what karma is about. Karma is not you do a good act and you get the Mercedes in the future, right? That's kind of, maybe you do, because, you know, if you like Mercedes, if you don't like Mercedes, it's bad karma, right? So so it depends on how you do this. The main point is actually the internal experience. That is what really matters. And that is actually what good karma comes down to at the end of the day. And what you can see here is that if you do a lot of those good actions, if you intend to do good again and again and again, what you are doing is that you're boosting that good karma and you're lifting up your mind, right? And this is how you're kind of cutting off the weights and allowing the mind to soar. At the same time, you don't do the bad stuff, so you don't have those weights that hold you down. And again, that again allows the mind to soar much more as a consequence. So this is karma. And of course, if you can see here, what is going on here is that if you build up all that good karma in this life and remember the one thing that we take with us from one life to the next one is our mind, right? So if you build a beautiful mind in this life, you take that beautiful mind with you into the future. And that is how karma ripens also in the future lives. So this is the idea of karma. It is very, very, very useful. Once you can start to see that connection inside of yourself, I really encourage you to investigate this, because it's not that hard to see. Once you can see the power of our actions on yourself, you start to see the urgency of doing what is good. To everyone, right? Every single person you ever know, to the most lowly person in society, to the highest one, you're always kind, you always do what is right, because you understand the power of kindness. To the animals, to anything basically. And then, of course, the path really starts to take off as a consequence. Now, to understand this in even more detail, I'm going to try to explain to you a little bit about dependent origination, because dependent origination actually shows you how this works in a very beautiful way. So I'm going to focus on the first three factors. This is going to be a little bit more heavy duty, right? So if you don't like heavy duty Dhamma, then just, you know, tune out for a while. But if you enjoy this kind of thing, then tune in. So the first three factors of dependent origination, okay, it's not that heavy duty. I'm making it sound difficult. I shouldn't really do that. So it's actually quite straightforward. So the first three factors of dependent origination. One, avijja. Avijja means, often translated as ignorance, which is a bad, not a very good translation. Ignorance means you don't know something. This has more to do with your outlook, your delusion, your lack of seeing things clearly. This is what avijja has to do with. So delusion, much better translation than ignorance. Ignorance is like, oh, I don't know the way to drive from Bangkok to Ayutthaya, right? That's kind of ignorance. But this is much more profound than that. It's a distortion in outlook. Right? So this is avijja. Then you have, in the dependent origination, you have avijja paccaya sankhara, right? You may have chanted this. We chant this thing. Avijja paccaya sankhara, sankhara paccaya vijnana, right? But actually much more interesting to discuss it than to chant it. So let's discuss it instead. So then from avijja paccaya sankhara means that avijja, this delusion, it has consequences. It conditions something, is the cause for something else. And what it is the cause for is this thing called sankhara. And sankhara literally means like to compose or to create something. Kara is from the verb karoti. Karoti in Pali literally means to do. And sang, the prefix, almost means like putting things together. It means like putting something together, making something, composing something. So because of ignorance, we start making stuff. That's what it's saying, basically. We're putting things together. We're composing. We're creating things. So ignorance leads to creation. And that creation then leads to sankhara paccaya vijnana, means that from that creation, consciousness is conditioned by that. And consciousness then eventually gets reborn in a particular situation. It's conditioned in this very life, but it's also conditioned upon rebirth into a new existence. So consciousness, which basically is the mind, is conditioned by these activities that we do, right? The creative activities. So this is the basic outline. So what is happening here? Now to understand what is happening here, it's important to understand what avijja, what delusion consists of. And there's two ways of looking at delusion that I will focus on now. And one of them is the sense of self, right? Now, so the sense of self means that we think that we have some effect in the world. We can go out in the world. We can sort things out. We can create stuff. We can make things happen, right? And not only that, but we are in charge of this. It's like I am in charge. And it's not the cause and conditions on me that are in charge, but I am this autonomous unit that moves independent of cause and conditions and does things in the world and makes sure that things happen. And this is the sense of delusion of being a free agent in the world, free from the cause and conditions around you. And this is the first thing that is important here with avijja. The second thing that is important with avijja or delusion is the fact that we think we know where happiness is to be found. Right? Oh, happiness is found in beautiful relationships. Right? Maybe, maybe not. Uncertain. But, you know, at least we can challenge these things a little bit. Happiness is found in more happiness than being wealthy than being poor. Of course, there is some truth to that. It's not entirely wrong. Yeah? But maybe it is a limited view. Maybe it's not all there is to the story. Yeah? So we think that we know where happiness is. And we think that we know where suffering is in the world. And because we think these things, we pursue those things we think are happiness. Remember, you think you are the agent. So you think you have the ability to pursue these things. So because we know that, we try to pursue the happiness and avoid the suffering in the world. Right? And we have been doing this for immemorial times. Right? And have we found the solution? So if we really had found the solution, we'd be really happy by now, right? And no more suffering. But have we really found the solution? Of course, the answer is no. There is an underlying delusion here. There's a problem here. We think we know these things, but actually we don't fully know. We only have a very tiny view of where happiness is and where suffering is, and we don't really see the full picture. Remember that famous statement in the suttas, what the noble ones think is happiness in the world, the ordinary people think is suffering. What the noble people think is happiness in the world, what the ordinary people think is happiness in the world, the noble ones say is suffering. So the noble one had a very different attitude to this. So, what happens is that because we think that we know where happiness is, because we think that we are these autonomous agents that can create the happiness, we go out, we start acting, right? We act in the world, we pursue relationships, we pursue careers, we pursue money, we pursue being well-liked by our friends and relatives. We pursue all of these things, all of this worldly interest that we then act upon. And that activity, that pursuit of things, that is the sankharas. We are creating sankharas, we are pursuing all of these things all the time. So this is what is going on here, right? That's the first link between avidya and sankhara. I'm sure you can understand what I'm talking about. It's not that hard to understand, right? Now, when we act in this way, when we make all of these sankharas, there is two ways in which we act out these sankharas. On the one hand, we can kind of go into the world and we can do positive things, right? We act with kindness to the people around us. When we feel that other people's ideas are aligned with ours, their interests are aligned with our interests, their happiness is our happiness, then we work in harmony together and we make good karma, we do good things, right? But sometimes other people's interests in the world are not aligned with ours, right? Sometimes we are looking for the same person to have a relationship with, or makes it very difficult. And so sometimes we clash with other people in the world because our interests are not aligned. We get upset with others, we get angry, we get driven by desire. Because we're driven by desire, we do bad things to other people then. Right? So we make bad karma. So this sankhara, the pursuit of our own happiness, based on the idea that we are independent agents in our world, it causes us to do bad things and good things, a mixture of those two things. And because we consider ourselves autonomous agents, because we feel, I am doing this, I am pursuing these things, it means that every time you do a good act, you have to take ownership of that. After all, you did it, right? So if you did it, you have to take ownership of this good act. Every time you do a bad act, you also have to take ownership of that. Because after all, if you are an autonomous agent, it means you have responsibility for that bad act. And because you have responsibility for these things, you cannot help feeling good about yourself when you do good things, and you cannot help feeling bad about yourself when you do bad things. So these activities that you do have a direct impact on your mind. Right? Right. This is what I was talking about a second ago. Right? About karma in this very life. When you do something good, you feel bad about it. Well, you feel good about it, hopefully. And when you do something bad, you feel bad about it. Right? This comes from the very fact that we see ourselves as individuals that have choices in the world, and we take autonomous acts, and when we do that, we have to have ownership of those acts. There's no two ways about it. And this is how we are, this, you can see now what's going on here. This is why the mind gets lifted up when you do good things. Why? Because you take ownership of those good acts. This is why the mind gets dragged down when you do bad things, because you have to take ownership of those bad acts. Right? It's kind of scary, but you are literally become the owner of all the bad acts that you do in your life. So this is how these stages, this first, these links of dependent origination work together. You're either lifting up your consciousness, this is vijnana, the third link, or you are dragging it down, having a direct effect on your consciousness and your mind through your actions. Sometimes in Buddhism, we talk about forgiving ourselves, right, to let go of the past and all of that. And of course, this is a very important part of things. So if you do something bad, yes, you try to forgive yourself. But the point here is that forgiveness can never be 100%. Forgiveness can only take you so far. There is always going to be some residual ownership of the bad acts you do. You're always going to feel a little bit bad about it. Complete forgiveness is very difficult unless you are a noble person, an Aryan, in which you can forgive completely because you understand the conditioned nature of all of these things. But if you're not an Aryan yet, right? So, it means ownership of that act is absolutely happens as a matter of course, at least to some extent. So remember that, and this is why we try to live virtuous lives, because we know the bad effect is going to have on ourselves when we do bad acts. So this is how things work, right? And you can see here, you're actually lifting up your consciousness and suppressing your consciousness. Then you live a long life, you have done kind of a large amount of either good acts or bad acts, or more likely a mixture of both, and your consciousness has a certain level when you die. If you've been a good Buddhist, done the right thing, hopefully it's a little bit higher, right, than it was when you started out. If it's lower, then you have kind of missed the opportunity and kind of going down the wrong Eightfold Path rather than the right Eightfold Path. But your level of consciousness will have a certain state when you die, and that is the state that continues on into the future life. You have kind of created your future life in this life by the level of your consciousness, and this is what it means that when you pass away into your next life, consciousness is already stationed at that level through your activities in this life, and you continue from there. Right? It kind of makes sense, right? It makes sense because you can actually feel how this works right here in this very existence, in this very life. So this is how karma works, and how then karma then affects your rebirth in the future, simply through your creation of the state of your mind in this very life. And this has some very important consequences. One of the consequences of that is that when we try to make good karma, it's important that we ask ourselves, am I truly making good karma, or am I just going through the motions? Very often in the kind of Buddhist societies, we are told, yeah, you should kind of be generous, and you should do all these kind of things. And of course, that is always good to be generous. But ask yourself if it is really having a good effect on you. What is generosity actually doing for you? Remember, it is supposed to make you feel better. That's how you know that it's good karma, right? If it doesn't really affect your mind, then you have to ask yourself, am I being generous in the right way? There is right generosity, and there is kind of generosity which is a little bit less right. It's always right, but it's kind of degrees of rightness here, right? Really right and a semi-right kind of generosity here. So you move it toward generosity which is even more right. The kind of generosity that makes you feel happy. And sometimes it is in strange places that you find the generosity that makes you happy. The Buddha was once asked by King Pasena de Akosana, I think it was, where should we give? Where should, you know, what is the right place to give? And the Buddha says, where you feel inspired. The Pali word is pasinati. It's a kind of word which means where you feel that you are, you know, at peace and feel inspired about things. That is the right place to give. Because when you give, when you feel inspired, when you feel good about it, it has a powerful effect on your mind, and you feel really good about it afterwards. So remember, giving is always good, but remember, if you give in the right way, it is far more powerful. And in that sense, you can actually improve your good karma even much more as a consequence. So this is rebirth and karma, right? Taught directly from dependent origination. And when it comes from dependent origination, you can start to assume that you're getting a very good handle on what is going on. Because this is considered, of course, one of the core mechanisms in Buddhism on how the rebirth process, how karma actually functions. So this is like a direct insight into the workings of dependent origination. Is it exciting? Is it nice? Quite good, isn't it? I think it's quite cool. You have, I mean, when you read the formula, you know, avijja, paccaya, sankhara, you kind of look at it and wonder, what does this actually mean? It's really hard to grasp what is going on. And this is one of the great things about it being a monk for 20 years. It has taken me 19 years to understand this, and now I can share it with you, right? Great, right? But this is kind of it takes a long time to kind of get a hold on how these things actually work. But that is basically how this works. So, what does this mean in more practical terms? Because this is all still quite theoretical. Yes, you can understand this by looking into your heart, seeing how it works. But maybe let's go to an even more practical example of this. And I've told this story before, but I really like this story, so I'm going to tell it again. And this is a story about one of the members of the Buddha Society in Perth. And he went through this past life regression. I have to warn you, past life regressions are notoriously kind of unreliable. You don't know whether what you actually hear when you go back through this thing, whether it's true or not true. It's kind of very, very unreliable. But this person, he went through this past life regression. Was another member of the Buddha Society who is a kind of hypnotherapist, so he takes you through these kind of things. And he's one of these people, the fellow who went through the regression. He's one of these really sturdy people, right? No nonsense. He's a businessman. He kind of has made his first kind of millions already or whatever. And he's no nonsense character. Not this kind of airy fairy, kind of living in the clouds kind of person at all. Very down to earth. Feet properly planted on the ground, right? No messing around. So he went to this hypnotherapist, sits down in the chair, hypnotized him, and he starts talking about this past life, right? And the details are coming out, you know, lots and lots of details about this past life. So he goes to the hypnotherapist once, and all these details come out, and he's kind of shaking his head, this can't possibly be true, right? He was a Catholic originally, and doesn't have any belief in rebirth whatsoever, so he goes away shaking his head, but it kind of awakens his interest. So he goes back to the hypnotherapist later on again. And again, all of these details about the past life coming out. He remembers being this poor migrant from Ireland. Lots of migrants from Ireland around the world, because Ireland had always this all this crisis, these famines, and all these kind of problems in Ireland. So there's kind of one of the, I think there's much more Irish people everywhere around the world than there actually is in Ireland because of all the problems they have there. So Australia too has a very large Irish ancestry population. So he remembered being this poor laborer coming from Ireland, right? Coming to Australia, getting a job in Australia as some kind of soldier. He could even see the uniform that he was wearing, explain what the uniform looked like, his shoes, right? And then marrying somebody, getting married to this woman, and I think he remembered the name. They had so and so many children. He remembered his own name. He remembered how many children they had. He gave up the army. He moved to the farm in a certain place. He knew where the place was, what the farm looked like, right? All of these memories. And then he built up this farm through really hard work, right? Coming from Ireland, being given the opportunity. He was so grateful for having the opportunity to be able to start from scratch and make a livelihood for himself. So he worked really hard and was a very successful farmer as a consequence. And when he died, his last memory was how proud he was of having achieved something in this world, right? And So again, when you came out of the second session of hypnotherapy, it was just, what is going on? This is just absolutely astonishing here. So of course, first of all, he rejected all this, but then his curiosity took the better of him. If I have so many details of a past life, surely it is possible to go to some of the registries and actually see if such a person existed. Right? Because they have so many details. Wow, and that's what he did. So he started searching until one day he actually found a person with the right name who was a migrant from Ireland, who had married a woman named so-and-so, right? And tick, 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 after a while, almost all of these things kind of worked out. There's always a few things that don't work out because sometimes memory gets confused. That's just the nature of memory. But the majority of things ticked. And when he saw that, he first of all, again, he didn't really want to believe it because it was too hard for him to believe. But over time, over a few months, he told me this because I know this person very well. He said to me, I had no choice but to change my view about rebirth because the evidence, at least for him, the evidence was so powerful, it was so personal, right, that I had no choice but to actually change my attitude to the idea of rebirth. And today he's an absolutely committed believer in rebirth as a consequence of that. So this is his story, but the interesting part about it is not just the fact that he became convinced about this, but the most interesting part is how it actually affected him. And this is where it gets really interesting, because this is a lesson to all of us, why rebirth is so important, why it actually matters. And what he said was that what was so scary about this was that in this life, he is a successful businessman, right? Very proud of his business, has built it up from scratch, right? He's selling some kind of equipment to the mining industry, right? This is Western Australia. This is kind of a running joke. Everything is about the mining industry in Western Australia. The whole economy is based on mining here. So, of course, if you want to sell anything, your best customer is always going to be the big, massive, enormous mining companies. Some of the biggest companies in the world are the mining companies that work in Western Australia. So very proud of this, having worked very hard and started from scratch. Right? Until he remembers his past life. And he sees that, well, actually, in that past life too, I was really hardworking, right? I built up everything from scratch. When I died, I was really proud of that. And now he sees he's actually doing exactly the same thing in this life. He used to think that he was doing this out of his own free will. I am building this thing up because I want to build this up. I'm coming from myself. This is great fun, right? And now, for the first time, he is realizing it's got nothing to do with his free will at all. He has always been like that. This comes from the past life. I have always been hardworking. I've always been proud of my work, right? It's got nothing to do with me. It's just a personality trait that has carried over from the past into the present life. And suddenly, instead of feeling proud of this, he became fearful because he saw that he was actually trapped in his own personality. It was a trap, and he realized, well, in my next life, I will be doing exactly the same thing. Right? Because this is something that is so deeply conditioned into him. And you can see how your personality becomes a trap, that you start off doing the same thing again and again and again, life after life after life, thinking that you're doing it because you want to do it. But no, what you're doing is you're running on a program. It's a bit like a computer program. You're running on a program that was written who knows how long in the past. And now you're being railroaded by this program, going down the same track, this steam train going forward at massive, large number of kilometers an hour, and there's no way that you're going to be able to turn it around unless you realize that there is a problem there. Right? It's very, very interesting to take this into account. This is what he saw, and he became so fearful. And it gave him a sense of aversion, he said, at least initially, aversion to this idea of continuing to build up this company, because he felt he was a slave rather than a master. He felt he was trapped rather than doing something of the free will. And the point, of course, is that each one of us is right there, where each one of us is trapped in our personality. You think that you are here of your own free will, right, coming to this retreat. So this is kind of the point. So this is what I was talking about, good and bad brainwashing the other day, right? So you have to find the good brainwashing. If you get the good brainwashing, then you are in safe hands. But so we remember that. And once you remember that, if you look at all those traits inside of you that oppress you, sometimes you get angry and upset about things. Remember that anger and upset is just a character trait that you have learned long, long, long time ago, maybe going back many, many lifetimes, that you're just automatically carrying on in this lifetime. And you will also continue to do so in the future, unless you do something about it right here and now, right? Now is the opportunity. If you don't do it now, you're going to keep on carrying it on with you into the future, being railroaded down those same tracks, not being able to get out of your personality. Your personality is a trap. Same thing with the desires, same thing with all of these things that we think we are. These things are actually dangerous things. And it means that you make an extra effort, especially to get out of those bad habits, those negative things. Because if you don't do it now, chances are you will keep on carrying it with you forever, you know, just going down the line, who knows how long into the future. So this shows you, and the reason I'm making so much a point of this is because it shows you the danger inherent in rebirth, how it tends to perpetuate itself, how you take the same character traits with you from life after life after life, keeping on going. And this is how you get stuck, right? How you are stuck in this samsaric existence, this perpetual wandering on. This is how it actually happens. And now you can start to see, going back again to the Buddha's life, right? I started off by saying always going back to the suttas. And when the Buddha explains his own awakening experience, he says, first of all, what he did was remember his past lives, right? Remember what I said about remembering past lives is like a chick breaking out of the shell, right? This little, inside this little kind of eggshell. And then one day you break out, whoa! Wow, this is what the world is like. That is what it's like to remember past lives. Right? You can start to see why that is the case now. It opens up a very, very different perspective. And of course, when the Buddha saw that, when he saw the trap of samsara, of course, that horrified him. He said, well, I don't want to be part of this. And because he saw that, it gave him that extra little oomph to enable him to make an end of the whole thing. Without seeing the horror of it all, without seeing how dangerous it is, the chances are he would never have made that breakthrough. You have to see the suffering, you have to see the problem fully before you're able to let go to the extent of full awakening. So this is the power of remembering rebirth, and this is why it actually matters enormously. And this is, I think, why the stakes, as I said at the beginning, the stakes are raised almost infinitely the moment you understand the idea of rebirth. And this is where the idea of monasticism really becomes significant. Because when the stakes are raised so high, because your entire future is at stake here, then of course investing more time and becoming a monk, becoming a nun, suddenly starts to make sense. If you only have a few more years left or a few more decades left in samsara, not such a big deal, right? You're out of here anyway, no problem. But if this is going to go on potentially endlessly, whoa, that is when the problem really becomes a serious issue. And then it becomes much more wise to invest more time and effort into this. Okay, so that is enough for this morning, a little bit about karma and rebirth. There's many, many more things I could say about this, but this is just talking about it in a way which hopefully would be practical for you and something that you can use in your own life. So again, if you have any questions about this and the things I haven't covered, please ask them and we will pick it up again this evening. In the meantime, have a nice lunch and I'll see you again at 1 o'clock, Andy, is that right today? Where are you? 1:30, so you have time to eat. Okay, good. 1:30 today. 1:30 to 2:30, yeah? Yeah. Okay, so we'll just pay it back to the Buddha Sangha.
Can I invite all of you to just introduce yourselves?